too little, too late for a Syrian border town. Today, Tuesday, October 7th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. ISIS fighters are on the verge of taking the Syrian town of Kobani, according to reporters a couple miles away in Turkey.
You can actually see the flag of ISIS with the naked eye. It's very small, but you can see it.
One Syria expert says President Obama has no choice now.
He has done everything in his power not to get sucked into the Syrian swamp. But by not moving in and not taking charge of Syria, the place has deteriorated, and now he's sucked in.
Plus, the Netherlands is a nation of part-timers, which has its perks and its drawbacks.
The cultural opinion of people, even with women who work 4 days, is like, wow, 4 days, that's a lot, that you can't be the full mom.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. If you have not checked out the Syrian city of Kobani on a map, you should, because it's pretty instructive. Think of Kobani as a kind of Syrian Tijuana, a real border town where the northern limits of the city are the Turkish border. So the black flags of the Islamic State are now flying within view of binoculars from Turkey. That's how close to a NATO member state ISIS is right now. Here's the 411 on Kobani, an ethnically Kurdish city before the siege, home to about 200,000 people. Now we reckon there are 10,000 people there, maybe less. The Kurds are resisting as best they can with assistance from U.S. airstrikes, but officials in the city say that without assistance on the ground, they don't think they can hold out. Catherine James has been writing for the British paper The Guardian. She's just across the border in Turkey. Paint a picture for us, if you would, please, Catherine. How close are you and what can you actually see of Kobani?
Well, basically, the view from Turkey, which has a hill opposite, is actually quite good. We're only about 2 kilometers away. And the Turkish military has now pushed everyone who came, the spectators, et cetera, supporters, has pushed it back to about 3 kilometres, but it's still quite visible. And as you mentioned, you can actually see the flag of ISIS with the naked eye. It's very small, but you can see it from that distance.
Have you seen skirmishes between ISIS and Kurdish fighters from where you are?
You can't see that level of detail. You know, we see the flashes of ammunition. You can hear the gunfire and obviously see the shells where they land and the smoke and the destruction it creates. But we can't see actual people.
Those flags you mentioned, though, they have such grim meaning for so many people at this point. What does it feel like to see them there where you are? A really kind of a threat to the population of this city.
Yes. Initially, when it went up, you know, you're looking at the whole city and you had to look specifically at a certain point to see it go up. And I suppose as the word kind of trickled down or was passed across that the flags had gone up, the mood was actually quite subdued. And when we spoke to the commander inside Kobani not long after, he immediately, before we'd even asked a question, said, "I know the ISIS flags are on the hill, but it's a lie. They're on the outskirts of the city. They're not inside the city." And, you know, they're really holding on with everything they've got. And they wanted to emphasize that it's not that ISIS had taken the city. They simply raised a flag just on the outskirts. And they're still holding out at the moment.
So is ISIS winning this fight, or at least do they have the upper hand at this point?
I think it's fair to say the Kurdish fighters in the city are outgunned. And, I mean, this is day 23 or 24 that they've been trying to hold off the ISIS advance. And they've been calling for international support that whole time. And I don't want to predict the future, but I do feel that most people feel that it's only a matter of time before they are overcome. The reports today that it has come down to street fighting. In that respect, I think the Kurdish will have the upper hand. They know the city. They've lived in the city. So like with any kind of guerrilla street warfare, the people that are locals will have that upper hand. But it's still, in terms of artillery, they are outgunned.
There have been more rounds of U.S. and coalition airstrikes. Are they making any difference?
It depends who you talk to. The commander inside Kobani yesterday said he wasn't sure they were making much difference. But then last night there was another 5 strikes. And from what I understand today, there was another 4. The Turkish president himself today in a televised address said that he didn't feel the airstrikes were enough. and he was calling for some kind of cooperation on the ground. I'm not really sure why he's only saying that now, given this fight has been going on for more than 3 weeks, but he did say that today. And it really depends where the strikes happen. The strikes probably could have started earlier. Maybe that it would have been more effective before ISIS actually reached the city, back when they were more on the outskirts in the villages. But yeah, at this point, I mean, I'm sure if they take out some of the artillery or the vehicles or the tanks they have, of course, that will do something. But whether it's enough is hard to say.
Reporter Catherine James speaking with me from Turkey, just across from the besieged Syrian town of Kobani. It's pretty clear that Turkey is facing a tough situation with ISIS, right, on its border. So far, though, it's been resisting the urge to get involved militarily. Stephen Cook is Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. I asked him first about Turkey's military capabilities.
Well, the Turkish military is the second largest military in NATO. This is a real armed forces. It has in its arsenal among the largest inventory of American manufactured F-16s. It has main battle tanks that are extraordinarily capable. They've manufactured in Germany. Some of them have been upgraded with Israeli technology. They're capable with drones. This is a military that is different from the surrounding militaries like the Iraqi military that essentially melted in the face of the ISIS threat.
Right. So not terribly concerned about taking on a group like ISIS. But what are the challenges of going into Kobani, of taking action in Kobani? And what if they don't take action?
Well, most of the challenges that the Turks face are largely political. I think certainly throwing the Turkish military into the fight on the ground against ISIS in Kobani would result in casualties. And like all militaries, they are concerned about protecting their own forces. But the real dilemmas for the Turks are essentially political. They are concerned that if they do take on ISIS directly, given the proximity of ISIS to Turkey, that there would be blood in Turkish streets in response, that ISIS would undertake terrorist operations in Turkish cities. And this, the second dilemma for the Turks has to do with their relationship with the Kurds. Taking on ISIS directly in Kobani actually helps the Kurdistan Workers' Party and its Syrian affiliate, which is fighting in Kobani. That's not something that the Turks want to do, despite the fact they are engaged in a peace process with the PKK. And then finally, there's a domestic component to this. There are elements of the ruling Justice and Development Party's constituency that sees ISIS as a legitimate force protecting Sunni interests in the region. It's a small part of the constituency for the ruling party, but there are national elections that are coming up in June. They are a high-stakes election. And President Erdogan is known not to be someone who's going to take any chances when it comes to these kinds of elections.
I mean, Turkey is a member of NATO, so I'm wondering when President Erdogan was going to the parliament in Ankara and asking for permission to get troops involved in this fight against ISIS, what was NATO thinking? Where is NATO in all of this?
Well, everybody's been somewhat cagey about how directly involved they're going to be in the fight against ISIS. And thus far, the Turks have not invoked Article 5 of the NATO treaty, which says that an attack on one country is an attack on all of them. There certainly has been some NATO participation in the fight against ISIS, but the Turks don't necessarily believe that its NATO partners will come to its defense. This has been a long-term issue for the Turks, although they're an original member, not a founding member, but an original member of NATO. So there is a concern in Ankara that if Turkey were to directly take on ISIS, that it would not have the full support of its NATO partners. It certainly would have the United States, would certainly have the French, would likely have the British, but the broader alliance may not help in the ways that the Turks believe that they would need the help.
What could Turkey do right now that it's not doing? I mean, what are the possible steps it could take?
Well, it certainly, given the dire situation in Kobani, it could use its sophisticated air force to complement ongoing airstrikes. It does have a large army, a large mechanized forces that can be pushed across the border to support those people who are defending Kobani from ISIS. ISIS does have sophisticated weaponry that it has looted from the Iraqi armed forces, but Turkey was built to face the Soviet military machine. Mm. It strikes everybody that they should be capable of confronting ISIS in Kobani.
Stephen Cook with the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also the author of The Struggle for Egypt from Nasser to Tahrir Square. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Marco.
Later on The World, why the U.S. has a lot at stake in Syria now. And the Nobel Prize for Physics goes to, you heard right, it went to three scientists who developed blue LEDs, light-emitting diodes. Blue LEDs basically make energy-efficient LED lights possible. And using them instead of old-style incandescent bulbs is saving us a fortune.
In terms of the energy that's saved in a country like the United States, it's enormous.
Glenn Zorpet is executive editor of IEEE Spectrum magazine. Making blue LEDs involves a little-known metal called gallium. So I asked Zorpet about the environmental costs of manufacturing LEDs.
It's a complex picture. First of all, let's look at another competitor, the compact fluorescent. Compact fluorescents are, I think everyone would agree, dirtier. I mean, there's mercury and other things. So we'll get them off the table pretty quickly. So
and I don't know anybody who really likes the light from a CFL.
Exactly. So let's kind of just look at incandescent bulbs and LEDs. You know, the incandescent bulb is probably more environmentally benign to manufacture since it doesn't involve things like gallium and so forth. But, you know, over the life of this bulb and the many bulbs you'll have to plug in after it to achieve one LED lifetime, you're using 10 to maybe 20 times as much electricity to keep that bulb going. So whenever you're comparing things like this, it's a much trickier calculation than you would imagine. But I would have to say that overall, the LED wins far and away in terms of its lesser effect on the environment.
I'm just curious, those blaring lights at Times Square in New York City, the big billboards in Shibuya and Tokyo, all those cityscapes around the globe, all those light-up billboards, is that mostly LEDs?
Yes, that's entirely LEDs. So it works in a way very similar to your television set, which is that whenever you're looking at an image, whether it's on a gigantic LED billboard or on your TV set or even on your smartphone, it's made up of pixels. And the pixels are red, green, and blue because the way the human eye works is you can create any color that right. We can see from red, green, and blue. So with a giant LED billboard, you've got red, green, and blue LEDs, which constitute this pixel. And by dimming or brightening the relative amount of light coming from each of those three, you can create any color.
I mean, our own building here at WGBH is known for its jumbotron that hangs over the Mass Pike. And it just strikes me that this global embrace of these jumbotrons and light-up billboards, every stadium wants one, every city wants at least one, would it actually offset the energy efficiency of LEDs at a certain point?
Well, that's an interesting idea, but I don't think so because of just the sheer numbers. Because it's not just the lighting in our homes and factories and office places, but you've also got to think about street lights, lighting manufacturing facilities, automobile lights. And even traffic lights. It's an enormous amount of lighting. For example, I don't know how old you are, but you may remember back in the days when traffic lights were incandescent bulbs behind colored glass.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I'm old enough too. But, you know, they switched those in the late 90s, early 2000s after Nakamura's invention. He had the green LED that would then let you make LED traffic lights. And the amount of money that one traffic light saves is absolutely huge. So if you just look across the whole country at how much savings accrued just from switching the many, many, many hundreds of thousands or millions of traffic lights to LEDs, that more than compensates for all of these jumbotrons and so forth that have sprung up in cities.
Yeah, I've noticed just on my own street in Cambridge, they recently changed the street lights to LEDs. I can see the little dots every night.
And that's another huge savings.
What about your own house, Glenn? You've changed all your bulbs out to LEDs at this point? Or
I'm
still kind of expensive.
Yeah, they are a bit pricey, although they've come down a lot. I'm somewhat sheepish to admit I haven't. I live in a small apartment, but it's on my to-do list. Right, exactly.
Glenn Zorpet of IEEE Spectrum magazine, thank you for explaining this to us.
My pleasure.
And it's The World from Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. I have a full-time job, and guess what? It's pretty intense sometimes. I wouldn't mind easing up. So I get the appeal of a place where part-time work isn't just accepted, it's the norm. You could call the Netherlands the part-time capital of the world, especially for women. Here's the number. 75% of working women are part-timers there. But as Sharon Lerner reports from Amsterdam, some women are starting to discover the downside of part-time.
My name is Diana and I have two kids, one little boy, Julius, of 15 months, and a girl, Olivia, she's 4 years.
Diana is someone I met in a playground on a Wednesday, and on Wednesdays all public schools in the Netherlands close at 12, and virtually everyone at pickup is a parent, because most people take Wednesdays off if they can.
All part-time. I don't know anyone who works full-time, I think.
Dutch women work an average of just 26 hours per week, which can make a schedule like Deanna's seem downright grueling.
The cultural opinion of people is that even with women who work 4 days, it's like, wow, 4 days, that's a lot, that you can't be the full mom.
One reason so many women here work part-time is a law passed in 2000. It allows most employees to reduce their hours without repercussion. The idea was to entice women with kids back into the workforce. And the part-time policies seem to have worked. About three-quarters of working women and a quarter of working men have taken advantage of them. But now, part-timers are learning about the limitations, said Saskia de Hoe. She's with the advocacy group Women Inc.
What is often forgotten is that part-time workers are giving up more than just salary.
Now, this is going to sound familiar to anyone who's ever gone part-time in the U.S.
If you work part-time, you get less promotion, and also the chance to get additional education or training.
De Hoe says that a lot of women who chose part-time now find themselves on the Dutch mommy track. That's what happened to Lucien Bresser. After her son was born, she dropped down to 3 days a week at the bank where she works. Then, she says, she was pushed out of the talent pool.
Being in the talent pool means that if there are opportunities or new chances, then first they think of you. So sometimes I explain that you have a little dot behind your name, so you're a little bit more special.
Bresser watched as people in the talent pool passed her by. She has mixed feelings about it. Even though she says she didn't advance as quickly as she would have if she worked full-time, she now manages 50 employees. And working part-time has been good for her and her kids.
I really love my job, and I hope that's a good example for them as well.
Bresser is a part-time success story. But in the Netherlands, half of all working women earn less than $1,200 a month. And that makes them financially dependent, according to the government, and financially vulnerable, according to De Hoe.
In Holland, a lot of women work about 2 or 3 days, so it's very difficult to be financial independence if you work 2 or 3 days.
She and her colleague, Masha Trummel, hold workshops for women on financial independence. And they've launched a nationwide campaign to raise awareness of the fact that the average Dutch man, over his lifetime, earns 300,000 euros more than a Dutch woman. In this video, called Where's My 300,000 Euros, two women go to the office in suits and beards to ask for a raise.
Success, hè?
Ja. Loonsverhoging.
Yes, sir!
But part of earning more is working more, and in Holland, many women still resist that. In fact, all the women I interviewed for this story work part-time themselves, including De Hoe and Trummel, and they warn other people about the downside of part-time work.
Yeah, we don't do it by ourselves.
It's a little embarrassing not to practice what they preach. But in the end, it seems that so many women here choose part-time work because they can. The economics make it feasible. And for Deanna Prost, the mother in the playground, the pleasures just outweigh the perils.
Now, probably the rest of my life, I hope I can be able to work 4 days max.
For The World, I'm Sharon Lerner, Amsterdam.
We log a lot of hours here in the U.S., too many probably. So if you had the chance, would you go part-time, even if it cost you promotion and pay? Let us know by adding your thoughts at PRI.org. If you look at news websites in Spain today, it's a lot like looking at American news sites a week ago, or today, to a lesser degree, perhaps. Lots of articles about Spain's first Ebola case, and lots of concern about the imperfect response, not to mention articles explaining how the Ebola virus spreads and how to stop it from doing so. That first case in Spain also happens to be the first ever case of a patient becoming infected with the virus outside of Africa. The patient is a nurse who was part of the team in Madrid that cared for two Spanish aid workers who contracted the disease in West Africa. Both of those patients eventually died. The nurse is now in the same isolation unit. Reporter Jerry Haddon in Barcelona is following the story. Jerry, what about the level of anxiety right now in Spain? Also similar to what the U.S. has been seeing lately?
I think so. There's a lot of nervousness. It's not really a sense of panic that people might actually get sick. This woman's been quarantined. But I think there's more of a realization that even here in Europe, where we've supposedly got better protocols for these sorts of emergencies, human error can occur and people can get sick.
Well, proper safety measures did not appear to have been in place in Spain. Can you tell us what people are saying about that?
We don't know yet how this woman became infected. What we do know is that she's a nurse. She entered the infected patient's room two times. Once was to remove waste materials, presumably blood or human fluids, from the patient. And at some point, she became infected. We don't know where the breakdown in protocol was, but we do know that this summer, nurses and hospital workers at this same hospital protested because they felt they hadn't received adequate training so far in the case of an Ebola case arriving to Spain. What they said at the time was that they had received decent training about how to protect themselves in terms of protective gear and so forth. But the more complex protocol within a hospital, for example, how do you transport a patient through public hallways? How do you sterilize or clean beds or chairs where those patients might have sat or been placed? So again, we don't know what went wrong here, but somewhere along the line, either protocol was breached or it wasn't strong enough.
What precautions did Spain have in place when this diagnosis was made?
Spain had an entire hospital designated and set up to deal with potential Ebola cases. So there was a wing of this hospital entirely prepared to take in patients, to treat them, to try to save their lives, but more than anything else, prevent the spread of the disease. And somewhere along the lines, there was a breakdown. The government has not yet said where that breakdown happened, and they're asking the media and opposition politicians who are already calling for heads to roll and for the health minister to resign. The government's response is, look, we're in the middle of a crisis. Let's get past this, and then we can talk about political responsibilities.
A lot of mainstream media in the U.S. has been criticized for kind of adding to the panic and not kind of speaking straightly about what Ebola is and how to deal with it. Spain's media, are they under a similar kind of microscope right now?
Yes, Spanish media is under the microscope right now, but I haven't seen any sensationalism or fear-mongering. There's been a lot of informational articles in the newspapers, especially going over what Ebola is, how it's caught, how it isn't caught, why ordinary citizens going about their business shouldn't really be worried that they're going to catch it suddenly.
That's reporter Jerry Haddon in Barcelona. Jerry, good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
News headlines are next on The World. You're listening to us on PRI and PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, the Japanese clothing store Uniqlo takes some heat for its strict work culture, to which the company's U.S. boss says,
retail is not for the lazy. We are a team. Our brand is a function of how well our team represents our brand. If you want to be an individual artist, I'm fine with that. You don't have to work for me.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Hasta encontrarlos. It's Spanish for until they are found. And it's a message you see a lot in the southern Mexican town of Iguala right now, scrawled on the side of buildings or on bumper stickers. It refers to 43 students missing from a school near the town, which is in the Mexican state of Guerrero. The students were allegedly kidnapped by local police and turned over to a criminal gang. The fear is that they were then executed and their bodies dumped in a mass grave that's been discovered. New York Times reporter Randy Archibald is in Iguala following the story.
These were students from a rural Mexico teaching college. They had come to Iguala to solicit donations for an upcoming march that they were planning. They also have a habit of stealing transportation in the form of buses. So there was a confrontation with the police. There was a shooting, a couple rounds of shootings. Three students were killed, three innocent bystanders as well. And then the really sort of disturbing chapter occurred when police rounded up several of the students. It's a matter of dispute or unclear exactly how many were taken away, but several of them were taken away. Video camera captured some of it, and they've been missing since. Now, the school and the students say that they cannot account for 43 of their classmates, but a mass grave was discovered the other day.
As far as those bodies in that mass grave, I know there's an intense investigation going on. Have there been any medical tests to see if they are identical to those kids who were missing?
The bodies found in the mass grave were badly burned, some of them dismembered, some of them decomposing. But the family members of the students have given DNA samples to try to identify the remains and see if they are, if some or all of them are the missing students. Separately, there's a team from Argentina with a long track record and history of investigating mass disappearances, because the students and the family members don't entirely trust the state authorities to carry out an honest investigation. So they have asked this team from Argentina to do a parallel independent investigation.
I'm just curious, could the confrontation between these students and the police just have been about stealing transportation, as you say, you know, being a bus scofflaw? That seems pretty violent.
Well, it should be said that these students have a history of radicalism and militancy and extreme protest. Both this school and the teaching profession in general is pretty radicalized in Mexico. The teachers' union, when they have a grievance, one of their tactics is to basically try to shut down the transportation in the city. With the traffic already terrible, it just gets worse, and they sort of communicate their message that way. In addition, here in Guerrero, this is a state that's very poor, that has a history of social unrest and social justice movements, guerrilla movements. So you factor all that in and you get a pretty tense political, social atmosphere anyway on a good day. So surely there was some anger or animosity over the stealing of buses, but it goes back further than that.
Well, precisely, because there is another layer to this, because it's been reported that two witnesses in custody told prosecutors that the gang, which included local police members, killed the protesters on the orders of a drug cartel leader known as El Chucky. What do we know about this guy?
He's not a known name here, but Guerrero is filled with dozens of cells and smaller divisions of larger cartels and organized crime groups. This group, Guerreros Unidos, is a pretty powerful group. Their principal means of revenue seems to be extortion and kidnapping, some drug trafficking. The bottom line is El Chucky was a local leader of this gang and apparently gave the order to kill them, and the motive is really not known. There's lots of rumors, but not really good information on what could have motivated such a brutal outcome.
In the meantime, Randy, parents are showing that they want answers by waving those signs that say "Hasta encontrarlos," until they are found. I guess parents are holding out hope that these corpses that were found in this mass grave are not their loved ones, not their kids.
Yes, I spoke to several of them. They had gathered at the school to meet with the Argentine investigators. It's a very heartbreaking experience. I mean, they part of the big pain in Mexico is never really knowing for sure. People go missing all the time, and families often don't know what happened. Clearly, a lot of them are abducted and killed, but there isn't really much investigation. In this case, there probably will be, because there's now tremendous international attention on the case, and Mexico's throwing everything but the kitchen sink now at the investigation. So perhaps they'll get some answers, but it's really the not knowing that is troubling and heartbreaking for these families. Until they get, you know, hard answers from the authorities about the bodies that were discovered, they're going on the hope that just maybe their sons are alive.
Totally understandable. Randy Archibald,
sure,
with the New York Times in the Mexican town of Iguala. Thank you for your time, Randy.
Thank you.
News stories like that one from Mexico are tough to hear, but we had a lesson on the world last week from Harvard professor Steven Pinker about putting this kind of story in historical context. So if you take the long view, the rate of homicides in Mexico is actually way down from what it was through most of the 20th century. Check out these numbers. Last year, there were about 19 homicides for every 100,000 Mexicans. That's pretty bad. About four times the homicide rate here and about double what it was in Mexico before the start of the drug war there. But the rate today is roughly the same as it was 20 years ago. Then look back to 1960, and the homicide rate in Mexico was at 32 per 100,000 people. And 10 years before that, it was 48, or 2.5 times as much as today. So, yes, the drug-related violence in Mexico today is awful and it's senseless. But just keep those other stats in mind. Mexican society as a whole is safer than it was just a few decades ago. Here's a question. Have you ever considered going gluten-free? For some folks, it's the healthy choice du jour. But for people with celiac disease, cutting out gluten isn't just a matter of choice, it's a necessity. So what if gluten could be disarmed, making it safe for celiac patients so they can enjoy bread, pasta, and pizza? A scientist in Italy claims to have done just that. Angelica Marin has a story.
I'm standing in the doorway of a southern Italian kitchen. Scientist Carmen Lamacchia is about to dish out her best recipe ever, one that took her years to master. Wet wheat grains rotate inside a microwave. They're ready. To the naked eye, the grains look just like wheat. But inside the grains, something has changed. A crucial protein, gluten.
After modification with the microwave treatment, we get an amount of gluten of about 80 parts per million.
That's 10 times less than regular wheat. Gluten is what creates that chewy texture in your bread, that tenderness in your pizza. We've heard a lot lately about how gluten is unhealthy and makes you fat. Lamacchia, who teaches food chemistry at the University of Foggia, says that's bunk. What she's concerned about is people with celiac disease. For them, gluten is toxic. It destroys your intestine, blocks the absorption of nutrients, and fiddles with the immune system. Lamacchia says, no more.
Oh, it will be a revolution. The part which is toxic, it's like hidden. The enzyme in the celiac patient's intestine won't recognize this protein and won't activate the inflammatory process typical of the celiac patient.
Lamacchia's method is now patented. She calls it gluten-friendly. But some experts say, not friendly enough.
It's unfortunate because I don't think that, this approach would be useful for people with celiac disease.
Dr. Alessio Fasano directs the Center for Celiac Research at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. A prominent expert in celiac disease, Fasano is impressed, but not convinced. He says you got to pay attention to the numbers. Celiac sufferers won't trust 80 parts per million.
They want zero. I mean, zero is something not attainable in biology. We had to really fight and fight hard with the celiac community here in the United States. And it took, 9 years of debates to convince the celiac community in the United States that 20 parts per million, it's okay because the immune system doesn't see it.
Lamacchia says the immune system doesn't see her modified gluten either. 20 or 80 parts per million don't matter if the quality of the gluten has changed. She says she has proof.
We did experiment on T cells.
Those are white cells from the immune system.
Coming from intestine of celiac patients. And on these cells, we tested extract from the modified flour. These cells didn't produce the inflammatory cytokine.
In other words, no damage, no autoimmune response. The next step is to prove that this works on a larger scale with clinical trials on humans. But the industrial flour companies around Europe are already banging on Lamacchia's door. Her detoxified wheat could rock the $10 billion gluten-free industry. She has the patented formula under lock and key somewhere at her university. Susanna Nailhold is food safety manager at the ever-active Italian Celiac Association. She's got a tough job in pasta land. That's why she's cautious but curious about the new gluten discovery.
In Italy, food has a very important role in social life. And to have to avoid a specific ingredient that is so present in Italian cooking, pasta, pizza, bread, is not easy.
But as Dr. Fasano from Massachusetts General Hospital points out, the term gluten-free had until recently become a joke, with at one point mineral water and bananas labeled gluten-free.
The industry had a tremendous role in pushing the gluten-free frenzy out there. And now they are focused on how long this is going to be, how sustainable it is.
It's looking good so far. 8 million people in the U.S. have celiac disease, gluten sensitivity, or gluten allergies. Both Fasano and La Macchia agree that's who should be eating gluten-free. Given the reality of American culture right now, Fasano says it's possible that gluten-friendly could become a hit. For The World, this is Angelica Marin, Italy.
You may remember a couple of months back we told you about the Japanese clothing company Uniqlo and how wonderful it can be for those of smaller stature. What many Americans probably don't know is that the Japanese retail giant now establishing a foothold in the U.S. might not be so wonderful to work for. Reporter Naomi Gingold, herself a fan of the store, explains.
I am a snob about Japanese fashion. After living and shopping in Tokyo for a couple years, I could not go shopping in the U.S. I just had no patience for it. The styles, the creativity, and the perfection of fashion in Tokyo. It just doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. Now, before you dismiss me as just a pretentious snob...
In Tokyo, you have access to so many really brilliant designers. I mean, I think shopping in Tokyo is the best shopping in the world.
Valerie Steele is a fashion historian at the Fashion Institute of Technology. Now, Uniqlo in Japan is not exactly fashion. It's cheap, good quality basics. But basics cut in a Japanese style with that attention to detail, here in the U.S., that is kind of fashion. Uniqlo's attention to detail goes beyond just the clothes. There's also been a lot of gushing over Uniqlo's Japanese-inspired customer service.
And it's very different because it's very Japanese. Like, two hands.
Delise Baker demonstrates how employees handle credit cards with two hands. Like, the cards are precious gifts. It's the formal Japanese way.
You know, you greet the customer always smiling, perfect posture. Things like that. Like, when we do meetings, everybody's supposed to stand... feet apart, hands in the front, always have your badges, the notepads.
Baker is a supervisor at Uniqlo's Soho store in New York.
You want to be facing the customer always, so they have to be greeted with a friendly smile, and also you say, hello, how are you today? You know, you always want to ask them how they're feeling, ask them if they need help, so that way we create a comfortable environment for the guests as they come into the store, and always want to come back and know that we're here to help them as well.
There are actually 6 standard phrases every Uniqlo employee has to memorize. Phrases that they chant to each other at store meetings. Also, Uniqlo folding is different. No table, you do it against your chest. And you gotta fold fast.
These shirts right here, they're button down. You're supposed to be able to fold 7 in a minute.
Customers like the service. But all the nitpicky rules, the rigorous standards, and emphasis on perfection have also gotten some flack.
Working environment.
Fumihito Matsuo is a former Uniqlo store manager in Tokyo. He laughs now, but says the working environment at Uniqlo is just bad. And it was so strict, it was like being in the military. In Japan, Uniqlo is referred to as a black kigyo. A black or evil company. A place that exploits its workers, from excessive hours to unpaid overtime and harassment. Some ex-workers in the U.S. have said it's worse than the military, more like a slave ship. And it's not just a few people complaining. In 2011, a Japanese journalist published a book charging Uniqlo with exploitive labor practices. Uniqlo sued and lost. Twice. They've now taken their case to the Supreme Court. Uniqlo's U.S. boss, Larry Meyer, says, hey, perfection has its trade-offs.
Retail is not for the lazy. We are a team. Our brand is a function of how well our team represents our brand. To that extent, it's not a free-for-all. If you want to be an individual artist, I'm fine with that. You don't have to work for me.
He says there are mechanisms here and in Japan to ensure that people are treated fairly and properly compensated. Fumihito Matsuo, the former Uniqlo manager, says working for the company did have its upsides. For a 23-year-old, only a couple years out of college, he had a lot of responsibility and opportunities to advance. He would not want to work there again, but says he still shops at Uniqlo, and so do I.
Do you guys also have the long coats?
We haven't gotten them in yet. That's like more winter.
Do they ever go on sale?
They do go on sale.
For The World, I'm Naomi Gingold, New York City.
Just ahead, old foes whose music sounds incredibly similar. So what's all the fighting about? On The World from PRI. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. At the top of our program today, we talked about the dark cloud hanging over Syria and fears that the predominantly Kurdish town of Kobani is on the verge of falling to the militants of ISIS. The U.S. and coalition partners today launched more airstrikes to support the Kurds fighting to hold on to the town, but the aerial assault has not been enough to halt the militants' advance. Joshua Landis has been watching the siege of Kobani closely. He directs the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Landis says Washington has a lot riding on the outcome in the Syrian town on the Turkish border.
This is the first time that our overall strategy in Syria is being challenged. A small enclave of Kurds, ruled in a semi-autonomous way, is now beset with Islamic State warriors surrounding it. It's abutting the Turkish border, and it's a little bubble that sticks down into Syria. All around it are Islamic State. They are trying to overrun it. Almost 200,000 of its inhabitants have already fled into Turkey. The question is, should America protect it or let it be ethnically cleansed? Can it get along with Turkey and agree with Turkey, its main partner in trying to deal with Syria, on what objectives are for Syria? And Turkey refuses to come up with a strategy for Kobani until America agrees with Turkey on an overall strategy for getting rid of Assad. So it underlines this chaos of our coalition in Syria.
So what do you think the United States military is going to do?
Well, right now, the military has been bombing ISIS fighters at the doors of Kobani. There have been six, seven, eight military strikes, quite a few, just in the last several hours. But there are no boots on the ground. Turkey refuses to allow other Kurds to go in and reinforce the Kobani people because it doesn't want this PYD group that runs the Kurds, and it considers a terrorist group, to begin to set up an autonomous Kurdish state in Syria. So I think the United States is going to continue to help as much as they can from the air and keep on negotiating with the Turks and hope that Kobani doesn't fall.
And I've read that the U.S. military is now using Apache helicopters, which to me says they're trying to get a little closer to the ground, more precise strikes. Is that just leading into possible boots on the ground at some point?
Boy, you know, this is exactly what happened to the United States in 1990 in Iraq after the Gulf War. Saddam Hussein began to retake the Kurdish zones. There was a giant flood of refugees out. It was of biblical proportions. It was caught on TV. And President Bush, the father, panicked. He said, we've got to do something about this. And he drew a line on the 36th parallel. And he said, no Iraqi jets over that border. And that was the beginning of a quasi-independent Kurdish state in Iraq. This little spot on the map in Syria could be the beginning of a similar effort to protect the Kurds, which would then emerge into a quasi-autonomous Kurdish state, and America would be responsible for defending it.
It sounds like we're a bit at risk of breaking what former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell called the pottery barn rule. You know, you break it, you buy it.
Well,
I mean, Syria's already
that's
broken,
exactly.
But will the U.S. make a commitment to Syria's future?
Well, that's what hangs in the balance here, and we don't know what the United States, and we don't know what President Obama will do. He has done everything in his power in the last 3.5 years, not to get sucked into the Syrian swamp. But by not moving in and not taking charge of Syria, in a sense, the place has deteriorated, and now he's sucked in because the violence in Syria did not stay in Syria. ISIS broke out into Iraq, conquered 1/3 of Iraq, and it looked like it would take Baghdad this summer. And that would have destroyed Obama's presidency. He had to respond, and he responded in a big way.
I don't like Monday morning quarterbacking, but if Obama had decided to really push hard back against Bashar al-Assad in the first year of the Syrian uprising, do you think we'd be in this situation today?
I think we'd be in Syria. Would we be with ISIS? I don't know. Most Syrians, as we see from the militias in the Sunni rebels, there are 1,500 militias, according to the CIA. Most of them are organized by town or by clan. A national ethos has not grown up that allows for one common leadership, as there was under George Washington, or you can name, you know, in Vietnam or 100 other places where insurgencies organized on a national basis. In Syria, they have not. The militias that have organized are the Islamic ones like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and we're trying to destroy them. So we're left with these little bits. And whether America could have destroyed the Syrian state under Assad and then rebuilt these little bits into a viable state is anybody's question. Obviously, based on Iraq and Afghanistan, President Obama said, I don't want to do it. Mm. And here we are with lots of little bits trying to somehow figure out how to put them together.
I mean, that's a really frightening scenario, and there are no good scenarios here. There's really bad and there's bad.
What everybody is begging for is that United States come over the horizon. You know, the cavalry rides over the horizon and saves them. The Syrian Sunnis want America to save them. The Assad regime wants America, in a sense, to save them. The Kurds are begging on their hands and knees for America to come and save them. Everybody is facing a very bleak future of perpetual war unless the United States takes Syria in hand.
Joshua Landis, great to speak with you, as always. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Joshua Landis. He directs the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. And now to a singer from this part of the world, so riven with tension and division, but whose music might be the perfect antidote. The singer is Ulçay Bayır. She's a Turkish-Kurdish vocalist, classically trained, now living in London. Her father is what's known as an aşık, a mystic musical troubadour. He is her link to many of the songs on her debut CD, some of them hundreds of years old, and from a broad ethnic palette, Greek, Turkish, Kurdish, and Armenian. This song is Greek in origin. Greeks and Turks, of course, have long had their own disputes. We've also heard today about the tensions between Turks and the Kurds, and Ulçay Bayır, as I said, is Kurdish. And don't forget, next door to Turkey is Armenia, and those two don't have diplomatic relations because of the Armenian genocide. But for some reason, in Ulçay Bayır's music, you hear how the styles of Greece, Turkey, and Armenia are pretty similar and have a lot of crossover. A hopeful note for you today from the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us on The World today.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include the Tagney-Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi. By the Ford Foundation, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.